Visible is a wireless carrier that is not invisible. It is pretty clear from the name. Actually, radio waves are invisible. And I can say this with authority as a licensed amateur radio operator. That being said, Visible won't be giving you the power to see light outside the visible spectrum. It's actually way better because having that ability would make getting around very difficult and distracting. What you do get with Visible is unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. You get one line of wireless, just $25 a month, which is great in these times of economic uncertainty. That is one line for $25, taxes and fees included. So whatever you're doing at this moment, please stop. Switch immediately. Now, monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Wir gerne sehen, was ist los? It's deinen Freund, Seth. I'm learning German. Yeah, in case you didn't know what that was. That is me trying to impress you with the little German that I know. Right now, I am actually learning German. I took it in high school. I goofed off the entire time. I did some other language learning apps. They taught me things like where the taxi stand is and how to find a bus, but not a lot of conversational German. Thankfully, that's what Babbel is all about. Babbel teaches you language conversationally, which, let's face it, that is what you want to know anyway. I don't know. When I was in school, you learned like how to count. You learned like the colors. You learned the shapes. Those are all important things, but they don't help you when you're in like Cologne, Germany with Ein Nierenstein, which, by the way, is German for kidney stone, an experience I can unfortunately speak personally to. But I've been using Babbel to learn to speak German again, better than I have before. I actually really like it because it is conversational. It's a little bit more relaxed. One of the things that it does that I really like is it'll sometimes show you what the literal English translation is. And I don't know why, but I find that very helpful in sort of understanding the structure, the grammar of a language and sort of putting myself into that mind space. Since I'm only in Germany for Gamescom, which is like a week, week and a half, I'm not immersed in the German language. I'm not immersed in German culture. So what I do is the second best thing. I'm taking Babbel. Hopefully this year when I go to Germany, I'll be able to impress all the Germans with how much German I know from learning through Babbel. The app has pronunciation recognition, so you'll be able to learn how to speak better with your accent, how to actually properly pronounce the words. That way you won't get made fun of by a group of older German men because you said apple strudel and not Apfelstrudel. No, it's really cool. I'm going to say right now there is a special limited time deal for our listeners. Right now you can get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners, because you guys are the best ones, by the way, at babbel.com/realm. Get 60% off at babbel.com/realm. That is spelled babbel.com/realm. Rules and restrictions may apply. Listen.
What is up, Super Ninfriendos? This is NVC episode 574. I am your elderly host, Seth Macy. I am joined here today by Kat Bailey.
What's up, everybody? I'm excited to be playing with power, superpower.
Per Schneider.
Hallo, mein Freund.
Hello, hello. And Sam Claiborne.
Hey, Seth. And I'm coming to you live with Kat from the new IGN Los Angeles Superdome stage.
I'm jealous.
Okay, for those of you who are listening and not watching, Sam and Kat are actually in our new LA studio, and it's pretty fantastic and professional and awesome. And there were some camera tricks and some shenanigans going on in there.
Tune
it was
in.
A celebration.
We're a big kid tune podcast in, now.
Meanwhile, I am still in my basement at my house, and it smells a little weird because it's a basement. But we have a lot to talk about this week, so let's get right into it. First off, we're going to talk about our No Man off to a great start. Our No More Heroes 3 review. Matt Kim reviewed it. He gave it a 6, which is a okay on the IGN.
Okay,
I believe.
Okay.
It's okay. Yep. You know, and sometimes a 6 is a game that you're either going to really like or you're just not going to like at all. It's sort of like a 7 in that way. I'm not what I'm talking about. But there was some embargo weirdness going on. Kat, could you please give us a little explanation into what was going on with the review embargo?
Yeah, sure. The PR folks had the embargo set for 9 hours after the game had already been released. So it would be, in theory, kind of a sketchy way of getting people to buy the game before the actual reviews had gone live. And it makes it look like they were hiding something. And sure enough, the reviews weren't super amazing, kind of what you would expect for a No More Heroes game. But it kind of reignited the discourse around reviews, because this is not the first time this has happened. Ubisoft has tried it before in the past. And there have been other instances in which, for example, Last of Us Part 2 was trying to obfuscate what was happening in the ending. And it's just kind of a bad look. Allow reviewers to be able to give the full perspective for readers who are actually curious about the game.
We're seeing some B-roll right here, and it's just want to cut in. It's the talkiest boss fight I've ever seen in my entire life.
I know a lot of people in the NVC Facebook group pre-ordered this game and picked it up. And mm-hmm. I think Matt said so much in his review. It was like, if you're a fan of Suda 51, then this game is for you. But otherwise, probably not. So,
if there's such a thing as a grindhouse genre for video games, this is kind of it, right? I mean, you're going it. You know what you're going to get with it. Mm-hmm. And honestly, like when I watched the video review, which, by the way, Matt did a great job, it actually looks kind of appealing in its own way. It certainly the action looks really strong. So I can see why like people would be pulled in. I think the biggest problem ultimately is performance issues, and the open world elements just aren't a huge evolution from what it was back on the days of the Wii.
Yeah, you said it was repetitive overall too, right? And like these games are never technically that great, but they kind of make up for it with just style and just the craziness on display on the screen. So yeah, I'm still gonna play it. I'm gonna check it out, but I know what to expect.
Do y'all remember when it was being shown back in the days of the Wii? Because the whole impetus for No More Heroes was everybody looked at the Wii and said, I want a lightsaber. Mm-hmm. Give me a lightsaber. Yep. And LucasArts was being so slow to give us a freaking lightsaber game. And here comes Suda 51 going, got your lightsaber game. And everybody was excited.
You know, there's always like a really great sense of mashing up retro games with contemporary gameplay in this. And I think like what I just wanted the series to become eventually was basically a fake retro game collection. And I think 2 had more of that than any of the others. But I don't need to play the lightsaber stuff at this point. I just kind of want to play a bunch of weird Suda 51
if you want, retro games. Just go buy Retro Game Challenge if you want the retro game collection.
Which is a really good recommendation. How great would that be on Switch?
Seth, you're my favorite person right now. Retro Game Challenge, secret best game.
I won't be your favorite when I tell you that I sold my box copy. So
what have you done, you monster?
It wasn't that rare. I needed a new. Listen, let's enough about this. Let's get to the exciting stuff. If you're listening at home or watching, you might notice that we are older than the normal.
Speak for yourself.
Crew. Yeah. Well, I mean, everybody. I mean. Pear is in his 70s. Mm-hmm. I'm in my early 60s, so.
did you guys?
Yeah, there's a little bit of a studio reaction to that one. Uh-huh. Good gag.
I mean, I'm sorry. I'm in my 60s, but the SNES, the Super Nintendo Entertainment System, the mm-hmm. SNES, however you want to call it, is 30 years old in the United States as of August 23rd. In 1991, mm-hmm. what a beautiful summer that was. I don't know if everybody can remember it, but I sure do. But yeah, this is sort of a timeline of the marketing rollout that Nintendo expertly executed in the lead up to the Super Nintendo. Was back in the September-October 1990 issue of Nintendo Power, they gave us our first look at the Super Famicom. And man, I remember this issue extremely well. There are 4 basically postage sized images of Super Mario 4, which we now know as Super Mario World,
right?
And I looked at those images until they burned into my retinas. I was so excited about the 16-bit revolution. What's
can
that
you spot the difference?
That's really
Sam,
look at the red buttons and everything. They did change the design. You know, the Super Famicom famously has the four different colored face buttons, which were also the Nintendo Super Famicom logo back then, and then you guys screwed it up all up for the US and made it all purple.
Excuse me.
What I'm surprised with here is the how late you guys got the announcement for this, right? So this is the September-October issue, and literally the thing was out a month later in Japan, which means, you know, Japanese magazines had been covering this for months leading up to the release. So,
well, it's interesting that internet you point that out. Yeah, because other magazines were reporting on the Super Famicom, but Nintendo Power wants you to know that you should look to future issues of Nintendo Power for hard facts. This is a direct quote, hard facts, not wimpy rumors. And that is with an exclamation point. To be fair, so was every other sentence in everything written in Nintendo Power. But yeah, that does anyone...
They embargoed themselves there, right? They embargoed... Yeah, yes. Nintendo of America embargoed its own publication to not talk about the things people have been talking about for a year then.
I think they were really focused on making sure the Super Nintendo was a very different sort of system in the United States than it was in other territories. And that was, you know, that was the exact marketing scheme they followed from the NES, where they just really wanted the NES to look like this kind of boring VCR box instead of the...
Right.
I don't even know how to describe what it looked like in Japan. It looked like a very toy-like, right?
Yeah.
But the Super Nintendo here, like, it wasn't, you know, it didn't look, it looked kind of like a weird early PC on its side in the United States, where it's like, you know, it lost all the, they added corners to it. Like, when was the last time that happened in tech? You know, everything just gets rounded.
Well, they wanted it to look like a VCR. So you thought it was a piece of home electronics instead of, you know, the toy that it really was. But
I love these mock-ups.
I wanted to point out in this article, this first article, they refer to Pilot Wings as Flight Club. And we all know the first rule of Flight Club. Don't talk about Flight Club. But I feel the Super Famicom aesthetics like blow the Super Nintendo out of the way, like in every possible way. The design of the console, the design of the controller button configuration, and like the box art for the Super Famicom.
You're so right. And actually, I know an indie developer named Jake Kasdahl, and he was a Nintendo game counselor back in the days of the Super Nintendo. And he said he specifically remembers the moment they brought the Super Nintendo into the office and showed it to the first time. And everybody went, "What have you done? This looks terrible. Oh my God."
They would have been the ultimate insider, so they would have known all about the Super Famicom, right? So like that's really funny to hear that reaction. I was just one of the kids that only knew about Nintendo Power, so I never saw anything. I had no idea there was a Super Nintendo out in Japan a year before we got it.
It's the early 90s, so I found out about the Super Nintendo when they started running ads for Super Mario World. They had that great ad with the kid walking up to the drive-in movie screen, and then it was very 90s with the lighting and everything, and he just slams the gamepad in, and the screen lights up, and he's playing F-Zero, and it's just like his hair's flying back everything.
Hair going back and sticking back. I probably first saw the Super Famicom or the Super Nintendo from a Genesis ad mocking Mario. I don't think that's true, because I was an avid Nintendo Power reader, but I was so much more hyped on the Genesis than I was on the Super Nintendo.
Interesting.
Yeah, and I mean, my friends were like completely swayed by the Sonic argument and about how Mario is for babies, but so much so that I really had to play Mario, and I really liked it, and I played it at a younger friend's house who had a Super Nintendo, and like crazy, but then I wouldn't tell some other friends that I played Mario games.
You're so right, though. Like, at that time, when, you know, circa 1993, 94, especially when Mortal Kombat came out, people were very much on the Nintendo's for babies, Sega Genesis is where it's at train, especially if you're in elementary school or middle school like I was.
Yeah. So. What are we showing?
That is what is really this mock-up of Mario. It looks like Mario teaches typing almost.
This is great value, what? Super Mario.
Yeah, this is not Super Nintendo Mario Brothers.
No,
this is
for the Amiga.
Oh my God, Pear, that's
Super
amazing.
Nintendo Mario.
Whoa. There you go.
Yeah, Pear is holding up his Super Famicom collection. And another thing about that I love is just the boxes Famicom games are so much better.
It doesn't even make sense to have a box with Mario World, because that was packed in. It would be so unusual to have a box Mario World here.
Yeah.
Can I just talk about...
Many are very understated. Look at the, like, white boxes and just the, you know, the beautiful art, especially the Final Square Fantasy games look so good. Yep. Connected. And then some are vertical. This drove me a little crazy that some boxes were vertical. Super Metro horizontal.
Cool. But, yeah. Like a movie poster. Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah, they're basically VHS tape sized, so they would fit on your, you know, entertainment storage shelf of whatever sort. But that was the first like taste that Nintendo Power gave us. It was so delicious and wonderful. And I, like I said, I burned those images into my mind. I was so excited for the Super Nintendo. And then in June of 1991, they introduced the Super NES with a feature called Introducing the Super NES. And they actually talked to the industrial designer, Lance Barr, about some of the design decisions. Now, granted, I was completely head over heels for Nintendo. So I never thought the Super Nintendo was ugly. I thought it was a beautiful work of art and the most perfect console ever created by human hands. And from that day forward, and I got to say, now that I'm grown up and I appreciate the Super Famicom more, the one thing about the Super Nintendo I like the most is that the buttons are concave on the top.
Oh, yeah, that's nice.
X on the bottom or vice versa. Mm-hmm. I'm not exactly sure. But Lance had a couple of good quotes. He said it's a directive from the brass at Nintendo of America. I don't know if you knew that, but they have a strict military rank system at Nintendo of America. They want a product that didn't look like a toy, he explained. The reason for that is the insides of the Super NES are anything but toyish. Bam!
Yeah.
Ooh, get real now. This is a serious video game system. The design was intentionally avoided flat angles of the NES because apparently spills were one of the chief service problems for the NES. Like, you'd be playing a game, eating your bowl of cereal on a Saturday morning, you'd put that bowl of cereal on there, cat jumps up, boom, forget it. Now your NES is ruined forever.
Remember back then, all the consoles were always sitting on the carpet, you know, tethered to a TV because, like, you know, little TV stands hadn't been invented yet. That sort of future technology wasn't available in the 90s. So, like, people fell over these things and ripped out the cords and the dog peed on them. All of that happened. So it was very important that it was not level and the pee rolled off to the front.
You know, looking at this preview, it occurs to me that at this time, Nintendo was a very different company from what it is today. It had a certain arrogance to it, which came down directly from the top, from Yamauchi, and a lot of that was to do with the fact that it had completely dominated the home video game market all through the 80s. It was like, we can do whatever the heck we want. We can roll this thing out in North America whenever we want, and we will dominate. Yeah. We own all of the department stores. You walk into a store, you will see a giant World of Nintendo set up. We have managed to push all of our competitors out, and they weren't reckoning with Sega, especially Sega of America. If you really want a lot of great context for this, go and read Game Over and Console Wars, both which show each side of what was happening at that time. Lots of great anecdotes.
That's a similar hubristic moment to when the PlayStation 2 rolled into the PlayStation 3.
Absolutely.
And, you know, the expense of the PlayStation 3 and how that was explained. And it was just, there was this expectation.
You want to have a second job to buy one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep, exactly. And you think you would learn those lessons. Nintendo actually changed. Nintendo just started claiming there's no console war. Right. And then it just went like a completely different direction for, you know, GameCube forward. And I think that was a really interesting way to go. But they were... they certainly got competitive after the Super Nintendo show.
Super Nintendo was a PS4 of its era, right? It was like all graphics, like this is the most powerful thing. Even the Super Nintendo itself, I feel like they were intentionally going for a futuristic look. And honestly, 9-year-old Cat bought it. Like, I was like going, yeah, that is definitely futuristic. Wow, look how amazing it is. Compare and contrast to the Sega Genesis. Well, the Sega Genesis looked cool. It looked kind of industrial, right? The Super Nintendo looked like it had been brought down by aliens circa 1991. Now it looks pretty toy-like, but at the time it looked awesome.
Yeah. It's funny because I lived through this era in Japan where, you know, and obviously Nintendo was steering from Japan as well back then, much more than, you know, NOA wasn't empowered the same way that they are now with having the biggest market. And like in Japan, you know, the Mega Drive, the Genesis popped up, but it was small, right? Like Sonic was known, but when you walked around in Akihabara or Shibuya, where all the game stores, Shinjuku, where all the game stores were, Nintendo was just dominating. Mm. It was the Super Famicom was everywhere. That was the talk of the town. You'll see, like, after a while, you see like little stands pop up with the 3DO, and then, you know, they were just gone a couple of weeks later. And it was just, you can see how if you had a very Japan-centric vision of the games industry, that, you know, that it took Nintendo a long time to overcome that hubris. And it wasn't until, you know, sports games started to dominate in the US and sell better on the Genesis that I think they woke up to that.
Pear, I would kill to have been in Akihabara circa 1991, seeing the scenes, being able to go into the store when all the kids were lining up, because the Super Nintendo, Super Famicom launch was such a big deal in Japan, to the point that they actually shipped them at night because they were afraid the Yakuza were going to hijack shipments and sell them on the black market. That was how anticipated this thing was.
So I remember, and like this little baby here, I picked up in Akihabara they had these small windows in these big shops specifically for these day of release order pickups. And like, you didn't pre-order anything, you just lined up. And so I went in the morning, the day before Final Fantasy came out, I think they, like a lot of games always came out earlier than the actual release date. And like, you could pick them up in Akihabara the day before. And like, I was in a long line that went around the block, and magically and somehow everybody got a copy, but it was just every time one of these big games came out, it was just madness. Just lines of people.
That pattern
was
set by...
Is that your original copy?
Yeah. These are all my...
Are you holding
up
four or five or six?
Six. This is six.
Okay. Yeah, but that pattern for waiting for the next RPG around the block, like that's like a Dragon Quest forward thing, right? That was like a common thing. But it's nice to be able to get them, because right now we wait in online queues and still can't get stuff. It must have also been nice to be able to buy Final Fantasy V, because we didn't even hear about that here.
Oh, yeah.
Final Fantasy Extreme, Sam. Yes, Extreme. That's what it was going to be. And then we got Mystic Quest instead. Here.
Yeah.
But it was also, you know, like it was the big Square and Enix Games, two separate companies at the time, that really created these giant lines, right? Like sometimes a Nintendo game would come out and it would be, you know, for something like Mario, I'm sure there was a line, well, it was launch day, but like it was really these big RPGs that moved the needle. And so that, you know, Nintendo probably should have paid a little bit more attention going into the N64 when none of those publishers were signed on to make games.
Yep.
And not only that, the Super Nintendo, think about the fact that DQ5 came out in like 91, 92, and then Final Fantasy IV came out just about the same time. So the Super Nintendo had that one-two punch almost immediately. It was a little like having kind of the God of War and the Horizon Forbidden West, even though they weren't first party, but it was on that level in Japan at least, not in North America, but Japan.
It wouldn't be...
And then lots of...
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, it wouldn't be until Donkey Kong Country that the United States would go ape poopy for the Super Nintendo. Like, that's when things just went off the rails, I think, and it just got really big, because kids here just were really into 3D graphics and did not want to get through those long Final Fantasy storylines for whatever reason.
This year, I decided I actually wanted to, like, follow hockey a little bit more than just the most casual of casuals, so I subscribed to a service that streams all of the NHL to your television. The Boston Bruins home opener, I went to watch it, and boom, blackout restrictions apply, which I thought was kind of ridiculous because I'm still 200 miles away from Boston, but whatever. Had I had NordVPN, that wouldn't have been a problem. I would have just gone in, changed my settings to another geographic area, and boom, I could have been watching all the Boston Bruins home games like it was nothing at all. So now I have NordVPN, and I can watch the home games of my local teams streaming without being frustrated. It's the same thing with like Netflix. It has all these complicated licensing rules, which from one country to another don't really make sense. So something you could watch on South Korean Netflix, you won't be able to watch on the United States Netflix, unless NordVPN, boom, switch to South Korea, and you're watching whatever Korean drama that you want. I highly recommend you do that. I haven't done it myself, but people seem to enjoy them. And who am I to try to bring down people's enjoyment? NordVPN, more than just entertainment and sports availability, it's going to protect you, especially when you're traveling, when you're using public Wi-Fi. People are trying to get in there. They're creeping on you. Bad actors, people trying to steal your password, your bank account details. Who knows what the government's doing these days? I can't keep track. They're all over the damn place. NordVPN, it's going to protect you. It's going to protect up to 6 devices, because I know you have at least that many devices in front of you right now that can hook up to the internet. Boom. Fastest VPN in the world. You're not going to get any buffering. You're not going to get any lagging. It's going to stop your ISP from bandwidth throttling, which they do. That's kind of sneaky, especially how much you're paying those guys. There's threat protection to protect you from viruses and malicious malware and whatever else. Unsavory actors are out there. If you want to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan, go to nordvpn.com/NintendoVC. That's nordvpn.com/NintendoVC. Victor Charlie. That link is also going to give you 4 extra months on the 2-year plan. There is no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. That's nice of them, and I appreciate that.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for 2 women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it, or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz and how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.
They love those curvy monkeys.
Well, moving from curvy monkeys to the games that first came out, the July 1991 issue, which also featured the famous Gulf War Game Boy, which you can sometimes see if you go to E3.
Oh, yeah, I had that issue. Oh, my God, I remember that letter very well. I mean, it's very famous, but I definitely had this issue. I remember it.
That's the Game Boy that was on display in the
one that was bombed and survived. It could still be turned on.
Yeah.
Well, it's in the Nintendo, or it was in the Rockefeller Center Nintendo World Store. I think that was what it was called, and it was on and playing the Tetris like splash screen on the display.
So crazy.
Really neat. But yeah, it's like totally melted out around the dot matrix display.
Yeah. Go Google it. It's pretty cool. But that issue had the first like look at all the games. It was the future gaming with the Super Nintendo Entertainment System and a fold-out poster, which was the games that were in the works for the Super Nintendo, which I actually have hanging up over there, which you can't see right now because there's a pipe in the way. But this one got me hyped. It's got ActRaiser. It's got F-Zero. It's just more marketing. It's telling you about rotation and scaling and animation. I didn't know what these were. I just knew that the Genesis didn't have it, and therefore the choice of console that I had made was going to be the superior one. Mm-hmm. So yeah,
and you were right, dude. The Mode 7 was such a freaking amazing innovation at the time. Such a great thing. Yeah,
Pilot Wings was one of my favorite games. I'm the world's premier Pilot Wings player to this day.
Who are you?
World's premier.
Wow,
I'm extremely good at Pilot Wings. Like I make it so that the instructors have, like, sometimes they have their eyes are real big and they're crying because I did so well. When I was younger, I could ace every single level. Like, I would get the absolute best score on all of them. But, like, these Mode 7 graphics, I would go to sleep at night and, like, see this in my eyes when I would close my eyes because it was so revolutionary. Now it looks terrible.
I don't know. I think it still looks good for a Super Nintendo game for sure.
Well, yeah. Yep. There's the problem with the interpolation, so it has that weirdness that somebody I think like 2 years ago actually fixed through a new algorithm. But
you're wrong. It looks amazing.
Well, I mean, yeah.
Where's this guy going?
I don't know.
No, you got some.
You got a land.
This is a pro player right here.
Mode 7 was used.
This is not going to work out.
Nope, he's going to die. Oh, he's going to make it. He's going to make it.
Maybe it's perfect. Seth.
That might be me. Yeah, that's my gosh.
Wow, great landing. Okay.
So 100%. Take that back. Somebody did 100 on a moving platform if you didn't watch this.
The Mode 7 very was difficult. Used to, you know, simulate the track in Mario Kart. It was used this way. It was used sometimes just to, like, stretch an enemy on screen. And
Turtles Arcade.
Yep.
It was in Mario World with the stretching Bowser clown car. It looked really cool.
I love that.
It was kind of a gimmick, but it was in a lot of when it was done well, it was done very well.
It was a step in the race to 3D. So, like, vector graphics had done 3D pretty well. Then iRobot had done the filled-in polygons. And then there was just, like, a few racing arcade games and stuff that were able to pull off a kind of 3D-ish look. And, like, having a home system that had anything remotely resembling 3D was interesting. And then Star Fox was the next thing. So it's really funny how Nintendo was just like, we got to get to 3D. We got to get to 3D. We got to get to 3D. And I know, you know, the development of Mario 64 and the Nintendo 64 was all about that, too. And, like, the PlayStation wasn't particularly good at 3D. Like, the 64 was.
No.
You could see that in Nintendo's sights. Like, we got to get to 3D.
So can we talk about...
In the beginning...
Go ahead, Per. Sorry.
No, in the beginning, you're right. You know, there were Mode 7 effects like the, you know, the flying clown car thing rotating, and it looked really cool. But there were a couple of games, and I was holding up Goemon 2, which never came to the US, which is honestly one of the best games ever made for the Super NES. It's
Journey of the Mystical Ninja in the US.
But this is the sequel to the legend of the Mystical mm-hmm. Ninja that you guys got, right? Which was butchered in translation.
Which has like this game, giant bosses in it, right?
It looks
this
amazing.
Game goes completely, yeah. This game goes completely nuts. And what the Mystical Ninja games did, and Super Castlevania did that too, was it actually used rotation for puzzles, where you're flipping the entire screen so the dungeons can be turned on their side and upside down, and so ceiling or wall becomes the surface at the bottom. And like, you just hadn't seen stuff like that before. And like, it took a couple of years for smart developers like, you know, Konami's Osaka team or Treasure to figure this out, and then it made for really good gameplay elements.
What was interesting was that the Super Nintendo's processor was actually fairly slow, all things considered. That was where the whole Sega Genesis blast processing nonsense came from. But it made a difference with the sports games, which is one of the big reasons that the Genesis was ahead of the Super Nintendo for a few years, especially in terms of NHL and Madden.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. Actually, the Genesis was twice as fast of a clock speed. And I know this because I wrote a compare and contrast essay on the two for my ninth grade English class.
So, but it didn't make any difference, though. It could just process code faster, but it didn't have any like direct effect on the game.
No, it didn't make any difference, but
it made it hard to program for.
Yeah, it probably made it really annoying to program for. And that was part of the reason why the blast processing happened. The other one was just the name Mode 7, because people could just drop that. Like, that wasn't really a thing at the time. Like, my console has this thing. Like, it was 16-bit, which they both had, and then suddenly Nintendo was able to say, but we have this one other thing, Mode 7. And then later they did that with the Super FX chip, right? Like, those were like these buzz technology words that were augmenting the Super Nintendo, the Genesis. They just faked it on the Genesis side. They just made something up, which is, I think, brilliant.
Yeah, and the Genesis was a weird... I had the Mega Drive, which didn't even have a stereo output. You had to go through the headphone jack.
Genesis,
it was really awful. No, the system was kind of messy, but like, when you unleash the best developers on it, right? Like, take a game like Gunstar Heroes, something like that, where they're actually messing with like early polygons as for bosses. You could see that the system had some power to it, but like, Super NES just made so many things easy with Mode 7 that would be really difficult to do on the Genesis. And so I think we got a little bit more creativity. And like, play a game like Looney Tunes, that's from Konami as well on the Super NES, and it's almost as fast as a Sonic game, right? Like, you just had to spend a little time, get to learn the hardware, and then you could figure it out.
The colors on the Super Nintendo were so vibrant. When you just looked at the screenshots, the still screenshots in a magazine, often they looked amazing. And one of the trends, you were just mentioning Looney Tunes. There was a big trend toward making games featuring cartoon characters, because this was the first time where it was like, it looks like a cartoon. Oh my God. Yeah. Especially in static screenshots, you're like, this is undistinguishable. I feel like I'm watching an actual Roadrunner cartoon here.
The color palette, or available color palette for the Super NES was like 32,000 something. And for the Genesis, I think it was only like 256. So it was a massive difference. And like you said, it just made it look like a cartoon. But the launch lineup for the Super NES was pretty solid. We had F-Zero, we had Pilot Wings, we had Gradius, or is it Gradius? Depends on who you talk to. Gradius 3 and SimCity. Who didn't love SimCity? I got to ask you guys, which of these launch titles do you think still hold up? Any of them, all of them, none of them? I mean, obviously, come on.
A lot of them, actually. F-Zero, Pilot Wings, obviously Super Mario World. I thought it was interesting that Mario World at the time was kind of poorly received as well, or as poorly received as a Mario game can be, because it was seen as kind of the lesser sequel to Mario 3. And they're like, oh, Nintendo's kind of out of ideas. This game is really rushed. And now I think that a lot of people will say it's the absolute best one because of the more open-ended nature of the exploration. But at the time, people were like, Mario World's kind of a letdown, and this game isn't backwards compatible. Super Nintendo, Nintendo's losing its
touch. A little baby for liking it.
Yep. I mean, there were actual news reports that were saying, like, parents furious because Super Nintendo is not backward compatible. Nintendo's just trying to do another cash grab. Typical.
Cash grab. Yeah,
I didn't know that. Out of those games, I would definitely say Super Mario World holds on, holds up the best. I mean, just kind of visuals and music, because Mode 7 does look a bit dated now, right? Because you have these flat planes, and so F-Zero is a little bit harder to enjoy now when compared to polygonal games and Pilot Wings as well. Gradius is interesting because it should hold up so well because it's a 2D shmup, right? But that game infamously had issues with the Super NES clock speed, and you get so much slowdown.
It's a feature.
The moment there are lots of enemies on the screen, and they try to stick closely to, you know, the arcade brethren here, and like it just slows down so much that
I'd like to
I think
see
if somebody played this now.
Well, somebody, an emulation specialist fixed it so that it actually didn't have the slowdown, and people are like, this is actually impossible.
Yeah, it's impossible.
There you go.
That's why you have to use the Konami code, but make sure you, there's some trick to it. I think you have to use the top buttons instead of left and right on the D-pad.
I think for Gradius 3, it's just a pause and enter. I can't remember. Yeah.
Yeah. But the other issue you have with games like F-Zero are now, I think it will feel weird for people to play it with digital controls, right? You're so used to having nuance with analog controls. And so playing it, it's like, right? Like the way the ships move, it's so digital and fast. I think a lot of people just constantly crash when playing it.
SimCity? Have you ever watched videos of people who like set world records in F-Zero? Crashing is part of the way that you set world records. You have to bounce off of corners and stuff.
I know. It's
absolutely insane. Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
I was going to say SimCity had a mark of Nintendo on it, which is really cool. Like, it was one of the biggest games in the world at the time, and it just wasn't going to be a great port because it was, you know, a little bit muddier and less clear on the Super Nintendo. So they just added a bunch of cool stuff to it with Professor Wright. I think that was what they called them.
Yeah, Professor Wright.
Yep.
Yeah, he's in Smash Brothers to this day. I think people would be like, why is this guy putting a skyscraper up? But that was kind of a nod to the heritage of SimCity.
Yeah, definitely wasn't my preferred way to play SimCity at the time, but I get it.
Oh, I played many, many hours of SimCity on the Super Nintendo. Remember Bowser instead of Godzilla came and destroyed your city at random times.
It's weird that Nintendo was really closely linked with SimCity, just like they were with Tetris, obviously, during the Game Boy days and afterwards. And they kind of let the SimCity one go, I think, after SimCity 64, that's sort of the relationship, that closeness to make unique games for Nintendo kind of ended. It's interesting. I wish they'd bring that back.
If you want that SimCity itch on a Nintendo console, I recommend checking out A-Train. That is a nice, fun little city builder that I didn't think I was going to enjoy, and I bought ironically. And then a minor obsession for a few days there. But those first few months of the Super NES coming out, we had a great launch lineup, and then we had ActRaiser, Final Fantasy II, Final Fight, Super Ghouls and Ghosts all came in November of that year. So boom, boom, boom. Final Fantasy was my favorite by far.
That was the system seller for me. I had to buy a Super Nintendo only once Final Fantasy IV came out, or two.
You mean Final Fantasy II, right?
Yeah.
Easy type.
I couldn't believe it. It was the most amazing game I'd ever seen or played. And Final Fantasy was my favorite game at the time. And so,
good.
It was the system seller for me.
And shout out to ActRaiser. You know, it's almost a forgotten franchise now. You know, there have been homages, but we haven't gotten real ActRaiser games. Even the second one that followed wasn't as good as the first one. But, one of the best soundtracks ever in video games.
Yeah.
They used Mode 7 for, zooming into the levels. It really created this ominous atmosphere when you entered the world. It had a little SimCity-ish, simulation element and side-scrolling.
Yeah.
And then I love that game. I love all of these games on the list, except I was very disappointed when I first booted up Final Fight on my Super Famicom.
Oh, yeah.
The one thing that I loved so much from the arcades was it was no longer two-player co-op. They dropped two-player, and then Guy was gone. Yeah. And, so you only had two selectable characters. And, Guy, they released a special edition where Guy was swapped in later called Final Fight Guy.
That was really bizarre. What a twist. And then they also released a chibi Final Fight on NES called Mighty Final Fight.
Oh, nice.
Never played that one.
I was unaware of that. It's hard probably country. One of the best games where you can eat a hamburger on the street, like bar none.
Oh, that's right.
December, one of my favorite Super NES games of all time, Super Castlevania 4, came out. And it's my favorite just because of that first level jazzy kind of music. That
the remake of Vampire Killer and jazziness.
Yeah, I love it.
Games like
this was actually the first Castlevania game that I played to completion. I never beat any of the ones on the NES.
Well, they were very difficult games at the time, so that makes sense. You could use Game Genie or codes to beat two pretty easily, but three was really hard, one was really hard. And then, then just waving around your whip like that.
Dude,
cool. That was awesome.
I was so mesmerized by the whip. Like, yeah, I just stood around at the beginning and just went, what? You're just, dangling the whip? Yep.
And there was very few scenes where you use the whip as a conveyance form, a grappling hook, but yep. They were really great. And that, of course, was at the height of Indiana Jones hype. So,
and they rotate the screen in one of those.
Right, I was going to say.
And the hallway, they got a Moat 7 hallway that spins this way, right? Like,
great game.
Yeah. Castlevania was really kind of underrepresented on the Super Nintendo, though. It's this and then the really terrible version of Dracula X. It's an unplayably slow, horrible port.
Very people expensive. Say Bloodlines is maybe... Yeah. A lot of consensus has kind of surrounded Bloodlines being the best 16-bit Castlevania.
Isn't that crazy? And then, of course, everything changed with Symphony. But, there should have been five Castlevanias on the Super Nintendo. It's just crazy.
Looking at
Wasn't there... Kid Dracula, right? Like, you got that in the U.S. too?
No, that was Game Boy, though. Right?
That was on Game Boy here, and it was on Famicom in Japan.
That's what it was,
Looking at these videos, I'm having memories of how I didn't get a Super Nintendo because my parents wouldn't buy me one. And so I was stuck with a Nintendo. Man. And the difference between a Nintendo and a Super Nintendo felt like such a gap. I mean, you look at the difference between, say, a PS4 and a PS5, and there's definitely differences. But at the same time, we're getting a 60 FPS patch on Horizon Zero Dawn. And everybody's like, wow, this 4-year-old game looks incredible. The difference between a 4-year-old game in the Super Nintendo era, like, you might as well have been looking at frickin' Stone Age graphics by comparison. Just the leap from Ghouls and Ghosts to Super Ghouls and Ghosts, or the leap from the original Castlevania to Castlevania 4, it was such an enormous jump. And I'd be staring at, I could just stare at a magazine and just drool at these screenshots. Just the screenshots were enough.
Oh, man.
Yeah. It was like suddenly the shapes that you had to imagine were trees were actually trees, and you had these colorful landscapes. And then the motion, the Mode 7 stuff on top of it was just really, really cool. And these games are still so infinitely playable. That's why I love that we have some of the good ones on the Switch now. That
yes, if you scroll all the way down to the bottom,
you'll
find some good games on there.
Yep. This game, by the way.
Super Nintendo Mini has a bunch of good games on it, so that's a good reference.
That is also true. If you have one, which I'm lucky enough to have. But,
are those
otherwise
permanently out of print now, you think?
Yes, those are not coming back. Same with the NES Classic.
Okay, because they announced that, right? They're like, we're not putting these back.
Hope you got one.
Okay. Yeah, they did a second run of the NES Classic just because they had no idea that it would be so popular, supposedly. Mm. And then they did a second run. But with the Super NES Classic, no such luck. You could get a Super Famicom Classic for cheaper and do what you want with it. Winkety, wink, wink. Now, I need to ask my panel, where does the Super NES sit in your personal listing, your tier ranking of the Nintendo consoles? Sam, where does the Super NES sit?
For me, it would be directly after the NES. The NES is my favorite console ever, and this is just an extension of that. And those are the two consoles that I spent the most learning the libraries, collecting. I have a completist mentality for NES, and this Super Nintendo would be the system I have the most of, the cartridges besides that. So really obsessed with it. They're also showing my favorite game for Super Nintendo right now ever, Metal Warriors.
Nice. You say that it was the extension of the NES. In a lot of ways, you could call it a Super NES.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
I don't know why they let me host. Kat, where does the Super NES sit for you?
Oh, it's the best one. A lot of it is, what did you grow up with? I know a lot of people who grew up with the NES and were like, yeah, that's the best one. But the Super Nintendo was truly the Nintendo at the height of its powers. It understood the the hardware so well. It had really refined the platformer into a fine art. Games like Mario World 2, Super Metroid, I think, is the best pure video game ever made. It's just freaking gorgeous to this day. Super Nintendo games hold up in a way that almost no other console holds up. And then you look at the brilliance that was coming out of Square and Enix. Like, those companies would never again truly match the creative just awesomeness that was Final Fantasy VI and such. All due respect to the PlayStation, which was also awesome in terms of those days. That was really the golden age of JRPGs. But the Super Nintendo, like, I just go back to games like Chrono Trigger, which for my money is the best JRPG ever made. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, Super Nintendo, if you put me on a desert island and you just gave me a Super Nintendo and the full library, I could be happy. I really could. I got a Super Analog NT in the mail right now. Yeah. Sam is giving me a CR television.
Yep.
And I'm going to be playing some Super Nintendo when I get home.
That is extremely exciting. What are your favorite games, real quick?
Oh,
I guess you said them.
Super Metroid, Chrono Trigger, Final Fantasy VI. I mean, those right there are all in my like personal pantheon. Dragon Quest V, not as well known in America, but for my money, one of the best games
ever
made.
Check that out.
Yep.
Yeah, it's on DS, and it's expensive.
So. Oh, yeah, you should play it.
Where does it...
My favorite console of all time is the Super Famicom. The Super NES nothing beats it. And as a matter of fact, like before this episode, I looked up our old top 100 games of all time, Super NES games of all time list. And I'm like, you just go through the entire list and I want to play each one of these 100 games. And like, that's very rare when you look at an entire console library that there's so many good games. And then our top 100 doesn't even have some of my favorites. Like, having played it in Japan, I got games like Live Alive, which is this Square RPG that's just absolutely stunning. We had Super Famicom Wars. We had Fire Emblem, Monsho no Nazo, was the mystery of the emblem. We had Goemon 2. We had Goemon 3, which was a Link to the Past-like game in the Goemon universe. We had Soul Blader. You guys got Soul Blazer, which was, you know, kind of Enix trying to do a Zelda game where you create the world and liberate it. Man, like, just think about it. Link to the Past, best game ever made. Super Mario World, Super Metroid, Final Fantasy 4, 5, and 6, Chrono Trigger, Super Street Fighter, Yoshi's Island, Super Mario Kart. It's like Ogre Battle, March of the Black Queen.
Tactics Ogre.
RPGs. Yeah. Tactics Ogre. We had RPGs. We had, like, in addition to all the Square and Enix stuff, we had Albert Odyssey. We had Breath of Fire. Like, we had all these games. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Secret of Mana. We had Seiken 3. So, you know, a game that didn't come to the US. Mm-hmm. Just the library is so rich. And, you know, as an RPG console, companies just experimented with so many different game systems from, you know, real time to turn based to like these kind of crazy systems. It's the best. Nothing beats it.
And we haven't even talked about the explosion of fighting games. I mean, when Street Fighter II came out,
multiplayer
on Nintendo,
exclusive Street Fighter II,
it was Super so Nintendo. Incredible. I mean, it was just, if you went to Blockbuster and tried to rent Super Street Fighter II, good luck, because that game was out all the time. And it really was, the arcade was coming home. Mm-hmm. This was almost as close to arcade perfect as you could get it at the time. The sprites were so gorgeous, and even to this day, still holds up.
Yep, there was a very good reason to buy an Atari to play Space Invaders at home, and then the NES to play a bunch of arcade classics at home. And this, man, arcades could not have come had a resurgence at a better time, because the fighting game explosion was so big. And honestly, like, I really like Mortal Kombat on the Super Nintendo. Mm-hmm. I thought it was like, it looked great.
Mortal Kombat 2 was good.
And Mortal Kombat 2 is really good because
it got a bad rap because it didn't have the blood.
But I think, you know, the Genesis had the blood advantage, but those games were just smoother and better and more fun on Super Nintendo.
I played a lot with my college friends. We played multi-tap games. So Bomberman completely dominated our time too. So like, just as a multiplayer machine too, it just succeeded. Big, sprawling single-player action and RPG games, and then all the multiplayer stuff. Tetris, Dr. Mario, Bombless.
We haven't mentioned Yoshi's Island yet.
Even mentioned how it has many of the soundtracks on the Super Nintendo, when they were making use of that Super Nintendo sound chip, which was difficult because a lot of third-party games would just be the guitar going down, 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 whatever. But companies like Square could just I mean, it was beautiful. There's a reason
strings.
That
they got like full like multi-tracked string orchestra sounds.
Or well, Superman. And let's
bass.
Let's not forget
bass
about
that
the
sounded really good.
Flat bass.
Yeah, and orchestra hits, of course.
Oh yeah, dun,
the most important.
Dun.
Feature prominently in TNMT.
Yeah, and Star Fox.
Yeah.
Oh my
what a machine.
Yeah, it's obviously, I mean, I think it's a surprise. This is my favorite Nintendo console of all time. My brother and I worked in the blueberry fields of down east Maine in the summer of 1991 to raise enough money to buy our Super NES from the JCPenney catalog. We ordered it from the Wish Book. So I didn't get it at launch, but I did get it, I think, in like before Thanksgiving. So
I might have gotten it used because I waited long enough, which was like super weird at the time to have a used console.
Yeah, I gave it away when PlayStation came out. I was like, well, I'm never going to go back to this. And I like regret it so much because I had, you know, a huge box of games and I had the Super NES Advantage controller, which was not a first party. It was made by ASCII, actually, which they also made the best third party Super NES controller, which is you can look up now. But yeah, I regret it. I wish I had all those games still.
Unfortunately, my original Super Famicom, I think, broke it. I think Fran broke it in the office, but I have a replacement Super Famicom. But my girlfriend bought me that one for my birthday back in Japan, and of course now we're married with three kids.
It was true love.
Oh, jeepers, yeah. Creepers. That warms your heart, doesn't it?
I didn't get a Super Nintendo till 1999, and I was working at KFC at the time, and one of my coworkers had two and said, do you want one? And I was like, yes. And I'm probably sitting here today because they gave me that Super Nintendo because the first game I bought was Final Fantasy VI. Nice. And that began my career in the games industry.
Oh, here it is.
Same. No, it was the same for me. Super Famicom got me back into video games after having fallen off after the Atari age. I had an Atari home computer, 600 XL with a RAM expansion, all of that. And then just kind of during my college days, I just played a little flight simulator on an old PC, but that was it. And then the Super Famicom got me into it to a point where I was like, maybe there could be a career here. So, yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Super Nintendo.
Thank you, Super Nintendo, for all that you've done for us over the years. Thank you for joining us on this memory lane walk through Super Nintendo's 30th anniversary, which is crazy to me. Super Nintendo is now old enough to start pondering its own mortality and what that means for itself. It's older than IGN, which is saying something. But now we have some Nintendo news to get through probably very quickly because I could have talked about Super Nintendo for 5 hours.
Same.
If I'm being.
Why not? Let's go. I'm not going anywhere.
That's right.
We have a strict time. You guys are in a real studio now and they have to clean up after you're all done. They have to de-Nintendoize the place. WarioWare demo is out. Has anyone played it?
No.
Yes. I did. It is WarioWare, and it's as silly and as nasty and as weird as you remember them. Like they have a new twist where, you know, the different characters have different abilities and they're unleashed on the same styles of puzzles. So, you know, whether you can like push sideways or jump up or throw a boomerang, you're cast into very similar looking puzzles. So your brain has to adjust to, oh yeah, my power is going sideways rather than up. And I really dig that. And it's, you know, it's the same kind of like poo-poo and toilet humor that WarioWare always has. You know, his favorite fruit is garlic. So you know what to expect. But I haven't played it with two players yet. I wanna try out the
multiplayer. No, I haven't
which
either.
It's really fun.
I get the fundamental twist you just explained that like now you have to kind of because the conceit is that you have to always figure out the game before you become good at it. You need to figure it out in like 2 seconds the first time you play it.
Yeah.
And that means that for each character, you have to figure out how to complete the game this time in a different way.
Yes.
Right? So knowing that, are they also using it as a spotlight for the Switch's fundamentally interesting control scheme, or are they just abandoning that? Because they very specifically said in the thing this week, which we're watching right now, which is like it's just thumbstick and NA button or whatever, right?
Yep. Yeah. No, and that's the one disappointing factor, right? Like if you remember WarioWare Twisted, really had this amazing haptic feedback feature. It just felt so unique and different to this day when you pick it up. It's just awesome. And like, this game doesn't appear to be doing that, you know, so it's unfortunate, but at the same time, you know, I still remember being supremely annoyed at games like, you know, there's a certain Metroid game that made you use the Wii Remote's features, and like, it happens to be the worst Metroid game because of that. Like, I don't want to point and then turn sideways and all of that. And maybe it was smart that they were being a little bit more careful with this one, but it does feel like a little bit of a missed opportunity here.
Well, it's still like 200 new micro.
1-2 Switch, yeah. Like, this could have been the 1-2 Switch for the Switch, right?
Like, that's what I was expecting at launch, you know? Like, that would have made total sense. But I think, you know, there's enough permutations of the Joy-Cons and the Switch itself now that, like, I don't know if that's really feasible.
They kind of gave up on the, you know, on the rumble a bit, you know?
HD rumble.
This would have been the game.
PlayStation is doing the most interesting stuff in the first party games.
Absolutely.
Like Astro. But, would love to see more of that.
Yeah, I've been playing it for a little while. I didn't actually play the original one. I know I've played one of the WarioWare, so I can't speak to it. But yeah, it gives me anxiety to have to learn a game in 2 seconds. It's like, it's too much for me. It's too fast.
So. Oh, man, it's so fun, though. And it's like, they do remix things slightly.
I love the Mario Land remix.
Yeah, all the retro references are just fantastic. Yeah. And then I just think it's the closest thing to a kind of a arcade remix that you can play right now. They're very arcade. It's when you walk up to an arcade machine, you have to figure out what the heck to do first.
That's true.
That's your first quarter or 10, right? I really like that about it.
It's very strange to me that... Go ahead, Pear.
Oh, no, I was going to say there are these strange obsessions that when somebody watches you play... There's this weirdness about pulling out nose hairs and things where people go, what the hell are you playing, right? But it definitely is a fun party game to bring up.
Yeah, I was going to say that I think it's strange that Nintendo had their big push to get into mobile gaming a few years ago and then abandoned it recently, and they never put this out there. Like, this should have just been a mobile game, and you could get, you know, like 20 mini games for 99 cents and just keep rolling it out. As it is now, this game is $49.99, which is less than a normal game, but it still feels like this would be a fun little thing that you could download for free and then just buy more mini games as you go. But
this is my one series I always say when people are like, what series do you want to bring back from the dead? Like, this is the one that I consider was dead because there's only a remix and then a weird spin-off game on the 3DS where you know it's like a studio game. And like that was it. So it's like, this is really like a comeback of a full WarioWare game. I'm really excited for it.
It does remind me of the days when there's just weird games on DS like every other week. So yeah, maybe we should bring those days back. But we also got, this is thrilling to me, a new Metroid Dread trailer.
Yeah,
today.
Great trailer.
Today, a great trailer, yeah.
Great trailer, but don't watch it if you want to go in unspoiled. Man, do they show too much. They show
they really
way
do.
Too much.
But what I don't if know. There's
what
so much more than
how
they
is it spoiled? Come on.
Oh, man.
I don't want to. There's an enemy.
I think that they were showing maybe the first minute or so. Like, that seemed like a very early sequence that they were establishing the very concept of the game. That I think they were kind of keeping that secret to this point, but they said that this is the grand finale for Samus Aran's, you know, saga with the Metroids, and it's also bringing it full circle with how she was raised and everything. I'm not going to go into that too much, but the main village definitely ties into her origin story, as we saw with a certain flashback, or what looked like a flashback.
Do we have to be careful about what we talk about? Because I thought that trailer was... you're right, it was totally revealing. I didn't think about that, because...
Yeah. Man, I would be careful.
Okay, well, I will be. Lore fans, though, that really like Zero Mission and Prime, which are my favorite Metroid games, I think this is a more of a continuation of those storylines than Other M's kind of baby verse that they kind of made that was also in Samus Returns. So I think this is a really good sign, this new trailer.
This is not, we're not showing the new trailer, by the way, the footage, we're showing the last one. But yeah, there's it's a great trailer. If you don't care about story spoilers or seeing some of the abilities and weapons revealed before you play it, watch it, because it'll get you more excited for sure. It shows different environments that you haven't seen yet. Shows you a very important boss. And then it shows some of her weapons abilities that that look really, really cool for solving certain puzzles. And so after you've seen this trailer, it'll be like, you know, when you go back to an early Zelda game now and you see a hookshot target and you're like, I know what I use for that. It'll reveal what some of those things are. So just be careful.
I had been a little bit uncertain about the actual look of the game. I was like, I don't know, this kind of looks like a budget game. That new trailer like definitely raised my excitement a fair amount from it.
100%.
It's flashy, and then it has a diff. Like, I don't like the mech designs in the first trailer. I mean, they're fine, but it showed too much
bland.
Of it. Exactly, and this shows the bio side of Metroid, which is like, you know, spooky alien stuff. Like, I really prefer that in my Metroid as opposed to the.
There was
tech
one
facilities.
In particular that looked great. I'm not going to say what it was. Yep. Amazing though. I was just like, oh yeah, all right, this is great. Uh-huh. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm right there with you, Kat. Like, I was the same. I saw the original trailer. You know, it's a Metroid game. I'm going to play it. But this one just aesthetically just speaks to me on a lot of different levels. And I'm very, very glad that I pre-ordered that special edition now.
Oh, yeah.
What were you going to say, Pear?
I grabbed that, too.
Yeah.
No, it's 30 minutes.
No, it's we should do like a spoiler cast sometime after the game is out. But like, yeah, it's my one worry. I had two worries, right? Like that the game was paced like Samus Returns with all the stop and go, and like they fixed that. You can angle your shots now, and it does seem to move at a faster clip. So I'm happy about that. And then the kind of sameness of the environments I was worried about, and the last trailer just shows you all this variety. So super excited about this.
Yep.
Yeah. Hype levels are up there, and it launches on October 8th, which is the same day as the Switch OLED or the SWOLED, however you want to say it. We got some more news that's in my wheelhouse today, and that was, of course, the Animal Crossing X Puma collection.
Oh boy,
sneakers, not the animal, but yeah, look at those things. If you're watching the video right now, these are some sleek suede Puma shoes, and I love gum-soled shoes like this. Probably not going to wear these. I do like to have a little bit of flair to my style, but the pastels don't really match anything that I have. So unfortunately, I won't be picking these up. But is anybody else going to try to pick up some of the Puma collection?
I love the color palette. It kind of reminds me of the Animal Crossing Nintendo Switch. So I'm tempted.
Yeah, that is. The problem with that is that one time Brian Altano was like, it reminds me of toothpaste. And ever since then,
it does
for me.
Please don't ruin it for me.
I'm sorry. You can blame Altano.
I just cut myself off. I got the full makeup run. It's just sitting in a box waiting for my, you know, collector cred to accumulate.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. No more. I have to stop with Animal Crossing. I got most of the merch at one point. Like, I got almost everything that came out, and I became obsessed with it. So.
Did you get those?
But what does Animal Crossing teach you? It teaches you that exact consumerism.
Capitalism,
right? It's like you start being, you start accumulating, and then I started doing it outside the game. It was a rough year, right? It felt good to accumulate real life Animal Crossing stuff.
Retail therapy via Tom Nook.
Yeah, exactly.
I feel like on the day the game is going to shut down, we will see the dark side, and it'll be like it'll be like Fight Club, the ending, and Tom Nook is going to blow up all the buildings and. You know, the ultimate lesson is yet to come.
Yeah. While the pixies.
Stop buying things, Sam.
I did. I'm not getting these. What is the little pouch, though? I want that.
That little pouch?
Pouch.
Yeah, there's like a little.
Where you keep your
extra
shoelaces.
It's a pouch for your shoelaces because cool people don't have shoelaces anymore.
Okay. So
if you buy a good, cool, limited edition pair of shoes, it will probably come with more than one color of shoelace. Like my Adidas Arizona Iced Tea limited edition sneakers come with three different colors depending on how I feel.
And your other color is shown here. You get kind of a white, off-white.
Yeah, white. And minty green.
Minty fresh.
Yeah, with aqua fresh.
Good stuff. You won't be mowing your lawn in these Pumas, that is for sure. Also Gamescom was this week.
Oh, yeah. It was
a little bit crazy. Not a big Nintendo showing this year.
They didn't show up for it,
but there was a few Gamescom announcements that related to the Switch. We get Dying Light Platinum Edition, which was announced for the Nintendo Switch. Marvel's Midnight Suns is coming to Switch and everything else.
That's good news.
And of course, Jumanji The Curse Returns, Squadron 51, mm-hmm. and Terror of the Hemosaurus.
Terror of the Hemosaurus. That's a Rampage like that I'm very into. It's like
it's like a Moat 7 Rampage, right?
Yeah, the
like
buildings get all curvy and sway. Yeah. Check out our trailer for that.
You and me both, Sam. It looks really good.
Yeah.
I like it too.
Okay.
Squadron 51 is a black and white World War II airplane shooter, and it looks crazy with like it's very Cuphead looking, but like 1930s black and white like newsreels with scratches and crazy narrators and
here's
stuff.
Here's the Hemosaurus. There's a sloth.
Oh yeah,
there's a sloth kaiju.
Yeah.
Oh yes.
Or a sloth. Love it.
Oh, I'm into this.
It's a multiplayer game. Yep.
Yeah, it looks 16-bit, but then all the effects are like crazy with, lots of rotations and big particles, and it looks really fun.
It's made by a solo indie studio, too. It's just one guy who claims to be caught in a alternate universe where the 80s and 90s arcade boom never ended, and I'm like, I like this guy.
That's so great.
There's a back.
Then Jumanji. Jumanji is basically just a board game simulation of what Jumanji is like. And so it looks a little bit like Mario Party, but it's actually not. It's whenever you're cast into a challenge, the four players have to work together on solving it. So it's like it's not a versus game. It's more like the movie story.
Saw the movie and that cartridge was haunted. So
yeah,
thank you. Keep those demons
still
away
haunted
from
here too. There were a bunch of other indies, we had a really cool show on IGN called Awesome Indies that Michael Swaim hosted. So if you want to catch up on that, go to our website. There are so many trailers, and obviously a lot of indies are either already announced for Switch or you know the drill. They'll go out on Steam, and then we get them a year later. It's going to happen. There's some really cool stuff.
Yeah. Agreed. And then Tom Marks will be on the show talking about the game that he beat a year ago that just came to Switch.
That's right.
It's very exciting stuff. It's time to talk about what we've been playing. Per, what have you been playing?
The WarioWare demo. I got, there were so many little releases on PlayStation 5 and Xbox, including Ghost of Tsushima, Iki Island, which just took all my time. But I finished it. I was playing around with WarioWare. I put Axiom Verge 2 on hold for now as I'm finishing all the other games, but I had to try out Wario, and that's pretty much it for now because I'm done with Skyward Sword. I'm Pit Crossing as always in the background, but those are just kind of like the when I have a couple of minutes, I play a little Pit Cross, but that's it for now. I haven't started anything big.
Okay. Kat, I'm very excited because I know what you've been playing, and I thought I was the only one. So please tell the audience what you've been playing.
Maybe the most underrated game of the year, Fuga Melodies of Steel. It's this tactics game where a bunch of furries are inside the belly of a metal slug tank, basically. Only it's huge.
Yes.
It's a huge metal slug tank. It's a little bit Valkyria Chronicles. It's a little bit, definitely has a Valkyria Chronicles vibe to it. And the tank is just kind of rolling along, and then you hit these set battles, and you have to move your characters around, get them into the different guns. It's like light, heavy, super heavy. And then the kicker is that there's this wave motion gun that if you use it, you'll have to sacrifice one of your characters, but it will instantly kill a boss. And I think Kotaku wrote,
you have to kill a child.
Yeah. Headline said, this game won't stop breaking my heart. And it's true, but it is a beautiful game. And honestly, the algorithm got me some, CyberConnect came out and was like, let's make a game for Kat. It's going to be furries inside a giant tank that vaguely resembles World War II. And I'm like, I'm in.
But yeah, I've seen footage of it, and there were some Advance Wars vibe just with the split screen setup and everything. But then I got a little worried that the game was too fussy. Is it more like an FTL with like the resource management and the different stations, or is it simple?
The way it works is that there's two basic segments. So the first one is the tank is rolling along, you get into an encounters, and you're fighting and you're moving your characters around and then between those encounters, you can walk around the tank, have conversations, build up relationships, and by having those conversations and building up relationships, you unlock additional abilities. You can continue to upgrade your tank. It's surprising how accessible it is, given that it's not a game that you would think of being super accessible, but I had a really easy time navigating it. And I'm into it. I strongly recommend it. Check it out.
Do you remember there was the Dragon Quest spinoff where you operate a tank with slimes, and I believe it's called Rocket Slime?
Rocket Slime, yeah.
Yeah, that's when you started describing this, it instantly reminded me of that, except when I actually saw an action, it does not look like that.
But. They're showing Pokemon Unite now. I'm still playing Pokemon Unite.
You're playing Unite?
Yeah. Blastoise is out, I think, very soon. So, hooray! Finally, my time has come.
Sam, what have you been playing?
All right, so I've been switching between two games. I'm playing Master Mode and Zelda, and to kind of get through that, I'm going really slow and, you know, grinding so I can not die instantly. And I've been doing that by going to the different regions and getting basically up to each boss, because when you do that, you don't trigger the difficulty level of all the enemies to go up again. So that's very fun to do. So I've basically gone all over the whole map, and I haven't completed any Divine Beasts, which is like, it's just an interesting way to play the game. And I'm also sneaking around a lot with Majora's Mask. But I'm also playing Axiom Verge 2. So Axiom Verge 1 didn't grab me. This one did. It has a really good Metroid loop to it that I'm very into right now. The traversal changes come really fast. So like I'm constantly retreading my ground a lot faster, I think, than in a Metroid game where I'm like, oh, I just passed three things that I can now go to. That feels good. I'm really obsessed with filling out corners of maps in games, and this has...
Yes.
It's just my thing. You know, it's like when there's like that little... You can see it right now on this. When there's that little chunk that you can't see, I'm going to be up there jumping to try to like clear the sky region. And this game, when you start doing that, you start seeing secrets and like things that are like not what you expect, and... highest recommendation for a Metroidvania so far. I'm only like 4 to 6 hours into it. But I have like, you know, maybe 5 upgrades. Like, I feel like I pretty much can recommend that game at this
point. Did you play the original?
Yeah.
And how does it compare?
It didn't grab me at all.
The original didn't grab you, but this one does.
So this one does also, because the environment is a kind of a flipped universe, and you're immediately in like outdoor environments, caves, a lake for a while. Like you're just, it's in it. Everything has that Super Nintendo pastel color palette. And then there's some kind of fantasy stuff. And like, you're just like, it's just surprising. It's like, it's not a usual setting for a Metroid game, Metroid-like, and it's definitely its own thing. And I definitely could recommend it, not knowing anything that happens in Axiom Verge 1. I mean, it's just like, the first 5 minutes you're in another universe and have to figure out how to get out of it, you know, like that's what you do in these games.
Yeah, I never played the first one. I bought the first one, but that's because I am like Sam with Animal Crossing stuff. I just buy things just to have them and then put them on the shelf. But I started playing this and I'm very much enjoying it, like a lot more. At first I was a little on the fence. I was like, yeah, this feels good, but it feels a little generic. But then once I started to do like what you said, Sam, like fill out those corners of the map. And unlike some Metroidvanias where you fill out the corner of a map and it's just empty space, I have yet to come across a spot that was empty in the corner that didn't have something there. And I really like that. I love the little drone when it goes through the warp. And then you have like these really cool, almost like Game Gear style.
Exactly. It kind of zooms. This game is not trying to look like a 16-bit game. It's just kind of looking like its own thing, right? But for the sake of comparison, there's a drone that switches into a world that's an 8-bit-like world. So it's like a bigger, blockier, pixely version because it's really small. And it's just a funny zoom thing. And that's kind of also like a dark world. So there's kind of like a flipped world that you explore in two ways. Like, a lot going on.
Yep.
Yeah.
Tiny team too. I think maybe one developer with like maybe a little bit of support.
That's incredible.
And the amount of detail that goes into this game and the love, it's really impressive.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Thomas Happ is, you know, obviously a big Metroid fan, and so this is his flavor of game. I played the beginning of the game and I liked it. I'm definitely going to continue to.
Yeah, I highly recommend it. We'll just play for like 10 or 15 minutes at a time. And then sometimes I'll play for like an hour or two, just depending on how I feel. Cause it doesn't feel like there's a lot of pressure. And I also, oh my God, it has the best thing every Metroidvania from here on out should have. And that is fast travel. You can fast travel between save points. You don't open that up right away. And I'm sorry for the spoiler for everybody who's really excited about not learning about fast travel ahead of time. So I apologize, but it's time for question block. Question block is, of course, when we ask the Facebook group, or we answer emails from listeners like you. It's me pointing if you're not watching the video. Adam, somebody is messing with my inability to pronounce things. Adam Vogt, V-O-G-T. Vogt.
Well,
thank you. Vogt. Donkey Sherman.
Bitte.
asks, what games do you advocate for that people still don't give the time of day? For an example, Adam says, I shout out Return of the Obra Dinn every chance I get. So what games do you... Yeah? Is that one of yours then, Pear?
Oh, yeah. You know what? I would have forgotten to shout it out if he hadn't brought it up again, but this is such a cool game. We talked about it at length on NVC. Tom Marks turned us on to it, I think, and we all kind of scoffed at it because we were annoyed at the artsiness of it, and then we all played it, and it's just so good. Such a clever adventure game that unfolds. The more you learn about the situation on the ship, the crazier the mystery gets. It's awesome. But I'll add two more quickly, and one is Luigi's Mansion 3. Mm-hmm. That is that's a big Nintendo franchise, and it just didn't sell as well as the other big Nintendo franchises. It sold well on Switch, but not to the level of a Mario or Zelda. And Luigi's Mansion 3 is just an absolutely fantastic game. It's the attention to detail, the animations, the love that dev team put into it. You have to play Luigi's Mansion 3. It's way better than the last two. And then Steam World Dig 2. I always have to bring it up. Great Metroidvania on the Switch.
Nice. Kat, do you have any examples of games that people won't give the time of day?
People who follow me on other podcasts will probably just be like, I know exactly what Kat's going to say. One of them is Valkyrie Profile, which is a PS1 classic, very rare these days, unfortunately, but I think it's kind of a lost classic on the PS1. And the other one is Super Robot Wars, a Japanese only, to this point, it's actually coming out on Steam in North America. It's available on Switch in English, but it's been traditionally only available in Asia. It's basically every robot series ever in a tactical RPG. So you got Gundam. There's one that has Voltron in it. If you can think of mecha anime series, it's probably been in this series at some point. Check it out. Love it.
Nice.
Super Roboto Tyson.
Exactly, yeah.
I bought one for the Super Famicom on a whim and was very confused at the time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, those games were really hard, too. But beautiful to look at. Great music, too. Mm-hmm.
Sam, do you have any examples?
Well, I just want to give a shout out to the kind of IGN office, because this is the type of thing like Obra Dinn is an example of something where, like, you know, somebody will play it and then they'll say everybody has to play this game and then we'll talk about it. You know, that'll carry out to like a few nominations for awards at the end of the year. And I just really like that. And so I think we do a lot of listening to people on game recommendations. And I think that's just a cool office culture thing that we have going. However, I will stick to theme here because I didn't get to talk about it earlier. And I think the one Super Nintendo game that people haven't played that they should play is a LucasArts game, which is really cool. What are they called? What was the original Lucas studio? LucasArts, right?
I thought it was Lucasfilm. LucasArts.
Yeah. So it's a game called Metal Warriors, which we showed earlier while we were talking. It's in a really amazing, graphically intense game where it's a platformer that you're working through a bunch of spaceships, and there's really interesting levels. But you can get out of these giant mechs, and there's all types of mechs. There's like one that rolls. There's one that sticks to walls. There's some like kind of big. There's one right there. You get out as a little guy. You get to go into another mech. And then the best thing about it is that the levels are set up so well. There's really cool anime-style cutscenes, even though, again, designed in some conglomeration of maybe Japanese and LucasArts developers. And I don't know the background. It looks really pretty the whole time. But then also, this has a two-player mode. And you're these little tiny humans, and there's a bunch of decommissioned mechs all over the multiplayer maps. And you hop in them and beat up your friends. And each mech has, like, 5 or 6 different weapons, and there's just nothing not to like about this game. It's just an incredible game full of secrets and brilliance, and I think it's like $250 now, so figure out a way to play it.
I think I will. It looks great.
Yeah, this looks awesome. Well, I don't really have any good examples of games that I advocate for, because I'm very basic. I just like the good game. Oh, Metal Gear Solid. Have you ever heard of that one? That's a good one.
Oh, no. What is that?
On the flip side of the equation is that I did talk all that smack on Fire and Ice, and then it came to the Nintendo Online.
Not bad, service, right?
And I played it, ironically, and it was like, it's an extremely enjoyable game, and now I know why the cart costs $150 loose, because, if it's on your Nintendo, if you have Nintendo Online right now, so go check that one out.
It works.
One more question. This is from Jimmy Val Peterson. Jimmy says, I was recently diagnosed with something called shoulder impingement syndrome, meaning my right arm is overworked, leading to an inflammation in my right shoulder. I'm going to minimize the use of my right arm for things like video gaming. My question is, do you have suggestions for great games that can be played using my left hand only, i.e. using only the left Joy-Con? That is a tough one. I was going to say WarioWare, but you still need to, yeah. I think, oh my God.
Find yourself a good turn-based RPG.
Yeah. I was just going to say, I think Octopath Traveler has...
This is my solution to everything. You know what would fix that? Find a good RPG. Turn-based RPG.
Yeah, definitely get into...
That's tough. I mean, Casey would be the best one to help here. But like, I was thinking about all the different game control setups, and like, yeah, most of the time, first of all, there's not a left-handed game where, you know, you got to remember it's just stick and the inside buttons then, right? If you only use your left hand on something, most games, there are a lot of games that only use one controller, but you have to turn it sideways. And so conceivably you have to use the buttons at the same time as the stick. Like even the puzzle games like Picross, I guess you can move and then use your left hand to hit. Yeah. You could use the pro controller, move and then, and then hit the buttons.
Yeah. Cause it's not timed or anything. Yeah. Right. So you just need to kind of get used to that. You know, and obviously, Switch doesn't make it easy. I think you'd be better off with some mouse and keyboard games for this, for my recommendation. But a lot of strategy games, I think, are going to be, not real-time strategy, but turn-based strategy. And maybe the one that Seth recommended earlier, The Sim, I'd never heard of that. And that might be one that
you... Oh, A-Train.
Yeah.
Yeah, that one actually requires a lot of button pressing.
I'm more complicated once you have to hold buttons while selecting others.
Yeah.
That's always an issue.
Yeah, to move across the map and stuff. Yeah, but I'm 90% certain that Bravely Default 2 does have a joystick configuration for just the left Joy-Con.
Oh, cool.
Please go check that out. I know I reviewed it, but I forget things a lot because of how old I am. But panel, this has been like the best.
Stardew Valley.
Stardew Valley.
Yeah, you could do that.
Animal Crossing. Yeah. Thank you, Pam.
Maybe those things. Maybe. There's some little bit of combat and jerky fishing and stuff like that. So. Mm-hmm.
Who doesn't love jerked fish?
Yeah.
I want to thank the panel for coming out for this incredible 30th anniversary celebration of the Super NES, which is most of our favorite consoles. We are out of time. If you want to hear this, oh, God dang it. We need to change that up in the run of show because I read it every time. To submit your own questions to Question Block, write us at nbc@ign.com or respond to the weekly Question Block post on the Nintendo Voice Chat podcast forums on Facebook. I want to thank everybody so much for watching and listening. And remember, NBC is the only place where you can
get the thing.
Get the thing.
Get that thing.
Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Buntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Buntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.